Welcome to the Building Science Podcast.
Bringing the human factor to architecture and design.
Brought to you by Positive Energy in Austin, Texas.
Okay, hello and welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the Building Science Podcast. I'm Christoph Irwin, and I am thrilled and honored to be here today with Gail Vittori and Pliny Fisk of the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems. I'm going to start the introductions. So Gail Vittori is co-director of CMPBS. Gail, would you like to give us a quick bio for yourself? Good luck.
Yeah. Hey, Christoph. Thanks so much for having us. So I'll just start my bio to say that in 1977, I moved to Austin. And within a couple of weeks, I found myself at an open house of the center. And let's just say it changed my life. I had been a student of economics. I found not a particular direction I wanted to go in with that. And so when I came to the center, it was suddenly like discovering the missing pieces that I never had that I was looking for. And a lot of that had to do with understanding place and understanding resources and acknowledging the power of having access and control of resources into so many facets of our life. So fast forward a few years, I started working here in 1979. And by the time around 1981 came along, I became the co-director and really got into, I'd say, some specific facets of the work here. A lot of it was understanding resources, both in terms of researching the availability of them, the significance of them in an ecological context, and also increasingly the health dimension of them. Mm. So over the years, I became much more focused on the health dimension of green building, which led me to some very extensive work in introducing the intersection of green building and the healthcare sector. Mm. And that resulted in establishing and convening several initiatives, including the Green Guide for Healthcare, which led to Lead for Healthcare, which led for me to be very involved with the first LEED Platinum certified hospital in the world, Dell Children's in Austin. And so if I were to sum up the bio, it's really a life of discovery, of adventure, of collaborating with incredible people, and having some opportunities to make a little bit of a movement in the needle on things that I really care about.
Hmm. That was an understatement, listeners. And my little quip of good luck was pointing to how much influence Gail has had in our industry over the years. And next to her, we have Pliny Fisk III. He is the co-founder and co-director and chief of Serious Commotion at CMPBS. If you could imitate Gail there and give us, you know, a few minutes of who are you and where did you come from and what have you done?
Well, I mean, your growing up makes a big difference. Mm. I grew up in an architect-designed home, but the family did not have enough money to build it. So we started out in the basement in New York State, and the house grew. So by the time I was 12 years old, I knew every facet of construction by heart. Making things and building things and seeing how they're done was unbelievably important. But the most important thing probably was the fact that it was in the ground, the basement. And the thing that saved our ass in winters, we were in the ground.
Thermal mass
and protection, because the roof were these unbelievable 10-inch deep beams right next to each other. And when the snow came, it insulated the whole thing. So we had the mass of wood in the ceiling, which gave us radiant temperature.
Mm-hmm. MRT, mean radiant temperature.
Mean radiant temperature. So all the walls were stone and concrete.
Was this in New York City or upstate or?
In the woods.
Wow.
So the next thing that happened is that you realize, my goodness, you're sitting 40 minutes from the biggest city in the world, and you're also exposed to the woods. So I would invent all type of strange things because Dad was this kooky inventor and Mom was an artist. So my fate was cast. So every time I would go to the mailbox, Christoph, and pick up a letter, my mom, when she was in school, decided to compete for the U.S. postage stamp and won.
Whoa.
So every time I pick up a letter, it was my mom's artwork. This is heavy duty.
Yeah, okay.
And so between that and the house,
yeah,
the fact that Dad never quite had his business plan together, so he started a high-rate compost plant, and the compost plant failed. So, Christoph, I lived and grew up in a compost pile.
Yeah, that's tremendous. Yeah, and so is there a relatively quick bridge from that as, you know, your origins, your early influences of CMPBS?
So then I went to UPenn in Philly, go to the birthplace of all kinds of commotion.
Yeah.
And so at Penn, I would be exposed to Lou Kahn, who lived down the street. I would get exposed to Ian McCarg in landscape architecture and planning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the daring thing of going over to Wharton and getting involved with system sciences. And then I did the screwy thing of going to the Bucky Fuller facility on Market Street, four blocks away, and getting involved with World Game. So I was totally destroyed in undergraduate and graduate school.
Yeah, just marinating in really big ideas.
Totally marinated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm still marinated.
So Gail, maybe you could take us from there. Do you know how he started CMPBS? How that?
Well, yeah, so after University of Pennsylvania, he and his then wife, Daria, were recruited to teach at the University of Texas School of Architecture and Planning. And so they moved to Austin in 1970.
Wow.
And were faculty there. They, in fact, when I came to Austin in 1977, it was in the summer when I went to the open house and Pliny was just getting ready for his fall semester class, which was a seminar in appropriate technology. And he said at the open house, you know, if there's any people here who would like to audit the class, I welcome you to come and sit in. And so I was one of the people who did it. And I think it was a spirit of very much recognizing the value of diversity and sort of opening up the university to the community, which was, let's just say, was not necessarily condoned by the department at the time. Also, the work going on coincided with the gas getting cut off in Crystal City, Texas, which was a big national story when that happened. And so Pliny became and was asked by the town, which had been sort
run
of
by the Rosanita
run
Party.
By the Rosanita Party. So it was very politically engaged city council and mayor. And the reason the gas was cut off was an illegal raising of prices for the monopoly gas that supplied the town. And when the town said, no, you can't do that, the gas company said, well, then we're going to cut you off.
Wow.
So the politics, let's just say, was very extraordinary. And literally in the fall, the December of 1979, the gas was cut off. And Pliny then engaged in a whole mobilization to get some heat happening. And then ultimately the Crystal City Solar Water Heater, which was a passive design, integral passive solar water heater that was constructed initially with all recovered, reused materials, including existing hot water tanks, fluorescent light tubes that would be cleaned off printing plates for the reflective surface. And then that initial prototype became the foundation for a design that was then manufactured with new parts, and they got funding from the federal government to put in a little small factory that could spit out 8 solar water heaters a day, right? And then they got them installed all over this, not just Crystal City, but adjacent towns as well. So it was a really incredible story. That one also was very broadly publicized. The Christian Science Monitor did a whole big story on it. It was a big deal. The Wall Street Journal did. So I think the commotion part of it, and what's important about the serious part, mm-hmm. that's not commotion just to make commotion, not just to kind of get a lot of attention, but it's to do something that's really addressing something that's serious, and to come up with something that is able to really reshape the way people think and see and understand to make a change. And commotion, I think, is fundamentally about the kind of change, making the kind of change happen that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nonlinear or coming from new angles. You know, in fact, let's just stay on the term appropriate technology for a minute.
So appropriate in terms of scale, appropriate in terms of location, appropriate in terms of skills, appropriate so that it's something that becomes a viable option for the intended user of it.
Yeah.
As opposed to an inappropriate technology would be something, you know, saying, here's this very sophisticated technology that costs a whole lot of money, that has very expensive parts for maintaining and so on. Here, we're going to give it to you. Well, that is not appropriate because that receiver of that technology has no ability to A, operate it, to repair it, to maintain it. And it puts them further behind versus moving them forward.
Yeah.
The extraordinary thing and the success of a nonprofit is, do people take it on themselves and just repeat it? So you know how many were built without any connection to us whatsoever? Towns all on the border. I mean, that's when the nonprofit versus a profit is successful in a totally different way, because it was stealable. It was done in such a way that everybody could do it.
Well, you want that to happen, right?
Exactly.
You want there to be this ripple effect whereby what you do as one example prototype gets picked up, and then it gets amplified because it gets broadly used. And that's a good thing.
So how did the appropriate technology with these solar water heaters, how did that tie into the origin of CMPBS?
Well, that was our first paying job. And it was sort of an interesting sequence, because we were the laboratory for maximum potential building systems at UT.
Mm.
When Crystal City started entering the picture, UT became very nervous, and they would not let students come out anymore.
Actually, Christoph, I need to make a date correction. The Crystal City happened actually in the winter of 77.
Okay.
The center was formed in 1975.
Oh.
So that had already happened. Pliny was still teaching at the university when the center was formed, and it was formed because there was a very generous contribution from the Minnell family, museum in Houston, that family, to provide the seed funding to enable Pliny and Daria to make a go of creating this nonprofit organization.
It was the hardest sell I've ever done, Christoph. It took me 6 minutes.
How did you happen to know them?
Well, there was a woman by the name of
Simone Swan
in the Adobe Hassan Fatih era. And I kept complaining that Adobe was the wrong thing to use, because it's agricultural soil, and started making a lot of commotion in that territory. And for some reason, Mrs. Delmonel said not only interesting commotion, but Fisk, when are you going to get out of that university?
Wow.
3 years of funding. She said, I'll give you 3 years of funding if you get out of there.
Wow.
Well, it took a few years to get out, but I think what's interesting with the connection, the Hassan Fathi, I don't know if you know that name.
No, I don't. I wanted you to tell me about that.
He's a very prominent Egyptian architect who wrote a book called Architecture for the Poor, which was essentially for him saying that enabling people to have access to the materials needed to build their homes,
right,
understanding how to do it, working with vaults and certain structural things that
beautiful
took away
buildings.
The need for a lot of engineered materials, but basically you can do these beautiful homes with the available earth. Architecture for the Poor was a very influential book.
And so what was interesting about it was that around that time, there was an article in National Geographic saying that Egypt is using the wrong material because they're building homes out of their agricultural soil. And that was what was going on with Hassan Fathi.
And did you write that article?
Luckily not.
Yeah.
Because it was out there. And so, you know, years and years later, when an intern and I presented at an Earth USA conference, she kicks me before we go up to the podium and says, "We're in trouble."
Oh, man.
And I say, "What kind of trouble?" And she said, "I forgot to show you a slide that there's an area in China twice the size of Texas that there's a moratorium on using adobe and sandy loam soil." And I said, "That is big." But she said, "You know what's bigger? You know who just won the award for the conference? A Chinese person, architect, who's building in the wrong place."
Whoa.
And so the entire conference came up to the podium, 500 people, saying, "What the f*** did you say?"
So, you know, part of takeaway of moments like that is the importance of being able to self-critique,
mm-hmm,
around some, let's say, values and principles, right? So it's not just like an arbitrary, we don't think that's a material, but it's really understanding contextually why using agricultural soil for building is really not a good idea, especially if you're trying to scale it.
Yeah.
Right at a time when we have such a significant loss of arable soil that is irreplaceable, right? And we have many other earth-based and other kinds of materials that are not conflicting with agriculture. So contextualizing the delivery of information is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. The industry is, it often seems to run by unseen levers. And who's pulling those levers and who decides what becomes appropriate or inappropriate? So you got this money and you had this organization on your hand, and then you had to figure out how to run it, what to do with it. Did that go just perfectly smoothly?
Oh, God, just perfectly smoothly. So what happened then is it was successful with the most radical Mexican-American groups in Texas.
Oh.
So therefore, you're invited to go where? Nicaragua, to the revolution.
Whoa, Pliny.
Well, let me just say, before he gets to that, the work was successful. The funding was allocated, but the funding was attempted to be blocked.
Oh, no.
By our then Governor Dolph Briscoe, who thought it was a
radical
significant
movement.
Right. Like, you're giving money to the little Cuba in my state. No, you're not. And so there was a need to have a lot of intervention to enable those funds to ultimately be released and end up with a really fantastic story of what happened.
So meanwhile, there's a lot of side commotion going on. Like, there is testimony to subcommittees of the House and the Senate. What happens if the whole country gets into a problem of towns getting shut off? Is there a plan? Is there a procedure of thinking? And that's when we created our first lens for a maximum potential future, which was a protocol that actually enables you to go and map resources, map people and businesses that connect to those resources locally, and then to assess it by how good is the network and stable is it, or do you have to go and reinforce that network? Mm-hmm. So that was the first one of our 12 lenses.
That's so important. Am I understanding correctly that CMPBS, and that's what I want to unpack with the lens, it essentially got crosswise with one of the most powerful industries in Texas, for sure, if not the world, as its origin story?
Oh, yeah.
Perfect.
So I was testifying and showing how we did this and how we looked at resources and people and so on. And then, lo and behold, they said, we'd like to fund you, but in order to do that, this is the U.S. Department of Energy Consumer Affairs Department, you have to convince people at the Department of Energy of this work. And every time I would be shown another person at the Department of Energy and mentioned the word Crystal City, because it had just hit national news because of the governor and refusing with Carter to have anything to do with this, they would show me the door.
Wow.
This happened 6 times until I got Barbara Jordan, Mickey Leland, and all these people behind it by letters to the Department of Energy head. It's the only thing that saved Max's pot in those days.
Excellent.
Because then they gave us a shitload of money. I think it was $5,000 or $10,000, which saved our butt.
What a story. And woven into really rich history, what a historical time. You know, what I failed to introduce when, you know, when we introduced you, we're meandering from introducing you and CMPBS, but listeners, please know that this Fisk character here, he won the United Nations Earth Summit Award. He has won the Exemplary Public Environmental Initiative Award. His work started the City of Austin Green Building Program, which was one of, if not the first green building program in the country.
And Gail Vittori had a lot to do with this.
Yes.
That person right there.
Yeah, actually, I should say this. Hey, listeners, both of these people, Gail Vittori and Pliny Fisk, have Wikipedia pages that are plenty rich to read. What we're going to try to do here is kind of do a narrative arc through their careers. And welcome to the podcast. So where we are now, I'd really, you just said Max's pot, and I keep saying CMPBS, which I did define once. Could you please, one of you, just talk about the name? Like, it has, you know, words have meaning. Let's start with.
Let me put it this way. In those days, Austin began to be conscious of what we were doing. And they refused to say the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems. So they took Maximum Potential. It's the first 3 letters was Max's pot. But you know what happened? So the UN in Vancouver 76, had a big exhibit showing the future of what they considered important work. And so believe it or not, there was a letter that came to the University of Texas, and it was saying Max's pot, School of Architecture, University of Texas, Austin.
Wow.
So what happened? I was brought to the carpet.
Oh, man.
And they said, what the hell is this? What's Max's pot? I said, why don't you forget about the Max's pot part and look at who the letter's from? It's from the UN inviting us for the first time in a school of architecture to the biggest stage on the planet. Have anybody ever been invited to the UN Conference on Human Settlements? They said, no, sir, what is that? So we took 14 students up to the UN in Vancouver and had a whole exhibit of Max's pot.
Which is the coming off of the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems. So how does that all fit together? So we have building systems and they have potential and you're trying to maximize them. And that means some sort of alignment with reality, energy flows and nutrient flows through nature, right? Something like
that. Well, I think the terminology building systems is really a systems thinking way of, we could look at, you know, the whole town of Crystal City and the region. Because if we didn't have maps, and we didn't know how to look at things, we couldn't have pulled that off nearly as well, because the town was being shut off.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, building systems had to do with building systems of consciousness of how this whole thing was working as a system and how to intervene in that system and to how to evolve it fast.
But here's the other thing about moving from the stoves, which was the first phase, and the mesquite wood to the water heater.
Yeah.
That the technology is super simple, right? It is understandable by young kids, by people, all people, right? It's just a basic, fundamental way of understanding how light can be reflected and then
bent
and then used as a like a greenhouse effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you have a glazing and it holds the heat in and it heats the water. I was just going to say, for me, part of the value of that is that as these sort of odd looking things were being distributed in the city and made in this little factory, and it provided jobs, local jobs, which is really fantastic. But I think it provided an accessibility to something that previously people had no control over.
Right. Natural gas was shut off.
That's right. So it's a big empowerment move. So when Pliny talks about changing consciousness, it enables people to see, like, I can be the controller of this part of my life. And that's a huge, powerful thing.
It is. That's beautiful. Thank you, Gail.
So people would ask, where did you get this crazy idea that fluorescent light tubes would actually bend the sun and put it more powerfully into a panel in the back? And I said, the American Solar Energy Society National Conference. So there's a constant preparation of what you're doing thinking-wise in front of peer-reviewed people that are much wider than where you're doing at that moment.
Oh, Hazel Henderson.
Hazel Henderson was brought in as part of Jimmy Carter's technology assessment group, and she happened to be with CSA, and I was presenting at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and she said, wow, that's as good as Schumacher.
Hmm.
So she invited me to present, believe it or not, with Schumacher to Carter in DC.
Wow. There's something so profound woven in here, which is that today, I mean, frankly, you guys haven't won yet. I'm glad you have undaunted optimism and keep trying. But today, right, like my internet signal, it's vital to my company. I am not in control of it. The electrical energy flowing to my building, I am not in control of it. It's vital. So we have these sorts of power structures in society that have nutrients and energy flows into their lives. And you were saying, hey, there is a more appropriate way.
A large scale farming.
So as he describes that and some of the other things that we've already talked about, it makes me think about, you know, Donella Meadows, who we mentioned before, and places to intervene in a system, and that the most effective way to intervene in a system is a mindset shift, right? That's where you are not needing to convince anymore, right? You've already cultivated the conditions to enable that change to happen. And so I just wanted to bridge into some of the stuff that I've done with the healthcare sector, right? Which was a very unanticipated trajectory for me. I had no intention or ambition to get involved with the healthcare sector until someone asked me to write a paper about greening the healthy and green buildings for the healthcare sector, right? That paper was presented at a conference, the first environmentally focused conference for the healthcare sector, called Setting Healthcare's Environmental Agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very clear that the missing piece had just been people communicating from the green building community to the healthcare community, saying there's an important connection here that hasn't happened and that desperately needs to happen. And over the course of the next 20 years or so, we were fortunate to be able to convene and engage that very risk-averse community to change minds and say there's more benefit here than risk, right? We're not going to get into this and be haphazard about it and arbitrary about it. We're going to be very intentionally focused on solutions that are going to be protective of patient health and safety. But we also know there's a huge opportunity here and a missed opportunity if we don't start making this bridge happen. And what we saw play out over the next, let's say over the first 5 years or so, was breaking down the mental barriers.
Yep.
And that was huge.
Yeah.
It was such an important part. And to see organizations start to shift and say, we want to know more. We want to start to try these things. There was a big exception, which was Kaiser Permanente. They were already sort of there. And I think because of their leadership and their interest in being very outspoken about it and very much an advocate for it, it was a big part of the puzzle of putting together the necessary pieces to make the sector-wide change start to fall.
Internal stakeholder.
Exactly. But to see it play out in the way that myself and the others who were kind of intimately involved, Adele kind of came along 6 or 7 years after that and got involved with the Green Guide. But I think the initial work of just laying the foundation of the why it's important, the how to do it, and having examples was exactly what we needed to start to turn that ship.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. And I can actually feel the tendril or the connection back to gas company shuts off an energy source. Plenty looks at that situation and says, there's other energy sources, you know, and it's a paradigm shift. It's like, no. You're not without resources here. You're without that resource.
Exactly. And there's other sort of bigger things always happening, right? So you're always in a context. So one of the things that we began to do as Gail got more and more doing this health work, we began to realize that we have prototypes, we have protocols, and we have policy.
Mm.
So the best example of how a nonprofit should be working is that you're doing regionally relevant prototypes, whether they be a material or a building or whatever it is.
Right.
And then you have something that measures that called protocols that are our lenses for a maximum potential future. So you're looking through those lenses. Sometimes it's through a lens of appropriate technology. People, how much do they lift? How much can they this? How much can they that? To a next level and a next level. So we have from the minute to the macro,
mm-hmm.
all these lenses. And then when it sort of hypothetically makes it through the lens, then you begin to say, it's time to get the policy happening. So while this whole thing is happening in Crystal City, the model was, how do you work in a rural area? So here I was being brought into Washington again. And what came out of that was the National Center for Appropriate Technology. So they said, here is an example of a group that we'd like these kinds of groups all over the country. How do we formalize this at a national level? And so I was on the committee that actually created that national group, as I was eventually with LEED and U.S. Green Building Council. So you're always trying to get things in a building systems sense, like building as a building systems.
Mm-hmm.
So you're building systems upon systems that begin to actually have effect at a bigger and bigger level.
Yeah, I just want to interject here that you just corrected a longstanding misinterpretation. Building systems, I thought of it as building as the noun and the systems within it. But a more appropriate connection is building as a verb.
Exactly.
And you're building systems.
Exactly.
Center for Maximum Potential Building System. It took me all this time.
And it's really both.
Yeah, exactly. I was just realizing it's actually both. because you are associated with buildings. Yeah, that's one of the fascinating aspects of this industry, and that building is a noun and a verb, and it's this really archetypal aspect in our lives, right? Everyone has got an intimacy with buildings. They think they know them, but you know, knowing a building as a noun is actually not a correct perspective. It is a verb. Like this building I'm in seems to be just sitting here. That wall over there just seems to be sitting there, but no, it's actively, dynamically mediating energy flows, right?
Exactly. You got it, man. And there's something else I want to mention, Christoph, and that is the extraordinary politics going on as this whole nice academic building systems, conceptual, theoretical writing of conference papers and presenting it, numerous, educated, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a shitload of other stuff going on.
Yeah.
So little did I know it. Oliver North and all that craziness.
Yeah.
That was being created by a senator in East Texas.
Wow.
So when I was invited to go and work with the Sandinistas.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Right. Nicaragua.
That was a heavy duty moment.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask Pliny to give a little bit of a background of what the Nicaragua project was.
Yeah, please.
So there's an anthropologist trained at the University of Chicago, had wealthy parents that were the wrong side politically in Nicaragua. He connected to a person at the University of Texas who headed up the
Institute for Latin American
Institute for Latin American Studies, saying, do you know of anybody that might get us out of a very interesting problem in Nicaragua? And that is, do the Sandinistas actually have a way of dealing with indigenous people? Mm. Because this is the East Coast with the Miskito Indians. And so Richard Newbold Adams had a daughter by the name of Tani Adams, who ran a nonprofit saying, these are the people that you should bring down.
Can I just give a little more nuance here? So when the Sandinistas got into power, right, by overthrowing the Somoza government, the challenge in Nicaragua is that there's almost like two countries. There's the country, part of the country around Managua, and then there's the country, part of the country on the East Coast, which is dominated by these indigenous peoples, the Miskito Indians, the Rama Indians, and the Suma Indians. So there had not been really a unification of the country in the prior centuries or whatever of governments in Nicaragua. And one of the intentions of the Sandinista government was to bring them together. Mm-hmm. There's a physical barrier of mountains and stuff, which is part of why there was sort of this separation. But their intention at the time was to try to bring them into the fold so that there'd be a one Nicaragua as opposed to these two separate kind of...
Mm-hmm. Different cultures, too.
Very different cultures. Okay, so I just wanted to provide
that. So anybody trying to help them solve the problem was being looked at by the Oliver North people. And what was that whole...
The Contras.
The Contras. So the Contras were being funded illegally through a shift of money through the U.S. that the senator in East Texas spawned in order to create this group that would cause trouble in Nicaragua. And so they would earmark people like me to get us, shoot us.
The work was initially to fund, so there was an organization in the Atlantic coast, the East Coast of Nicaragua, called the Center for the Development of Indigenous Communities, essentially. It was called SITCA. And so the anthropologist from the University of Chicago founded that organization. And the goal was to establish a methodology for building housing for underhoused indigenous populations on the Atlantic coast. Part of the challenge there was caused by a wiping away of resources by United Fruit Company that went and decided that it was the perfect place for banana plantations.
And wiped out humongous forests. So the very materials that they used were gone.
So how do we come up with a appropriate technology, place-based, viable housing form, taking advantage of the resources that now exist, right? Given that the resource base that had been there was no longer there. That was the problem to solve.
So the first thing I did is do maps of the country. Mm-hmm. I did maps of South Texas to figure out where there are alternatives.
And when you say maps, I want to be clear. I'm guessing it's not just like dimensional maps. It's resource maps, right?
Resource maps and distances and amounts and quantities.
What's there? What's there in terms of naturally occurring resources? What's there as byproduct resources? What's there climatically, you know, in terms of temperature, rainfall, and so on?
And the human resources, their capabilities?
Human resources all mapped out. So the whole town of
Puerto
Cabezas, I mapped related to all the businesses and all the skills and the schools and the vocational programs and what they were teaching.
Wow. And when you say I mapped, like I Pliny or I my group, or how many people went down there?
They would not allow anybody else in.
Oh, so it was just you, literally. And Gail, you weren't there.
They wouldn't let me go.
So you were just like freaking out at home, freaking out back here in Austin.
Yeah, with a very young child.
Oh my goodness. What a time.
So I found a person that knew a lot about everything. And I had been asked to join a line to go and check out another part of the country. And I thought, well, whoa, I can check out some resources. I'm going to go on that line. So they said, sure. And by the way, you're going to ride shotgun now that you have 20 minutes training on this AK-47.
So you learned how to fire an AK-47 as part of your...
Oh, yeah. So I brought my AK-47 that, by the way, always rested by my bedside because you never know what was going to happen. And away we went. And I suddenly realized that I had an assistant that I had hired locally at my lab, and I said to the head of the institute, I said, you know, I don't quite trust what's going on while we're away. And he said, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, I'm having him do oven experiments with a certain soil so we can make cisterns and catch water at the point of 130 inches of water. You should be not getting any centralized water system of any kind, because the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to get blown up.
Yeah.
And soon enough, they were all blown up. So, Plenty, why don't we go back and check the lab out so you don't burn down this whole place? And I said, brilliant. And I said, oh, shit. By the way, I had forgotten that tonight we're going to have dinner with the one guy that can get us out of the food problem and is bring food in from Cuba. Wow, well, why didn't you tell me that? I'm telling you now. So we go to dinner to this place. In the middle of dinner, this guy hears a toot out in front, and he gets up and he disappears for 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And he comes back and he's shaking his head. And we say, what's going on? And he said, you know that column that was going out this morning that I think you guys were part of? I'm the town undertaker. They're all dead.
Whoa.
So it's sort of that close.
If you hadn't gone to that dinner.
Hadn't gone to that dinner? No way. They were all shot by the Contras.
Yeah.
All funded by the U.S.
So the thing that we found out about civil wars like that is that...
You never know.
You never know. It becomes very personal as opposed to principle-based. So, for example, if someone had a brother killed by the Contras, the family probably would be on the Sandinista side. if that person was killed by a Sandinista, they would probably be on the countryside, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, not to say that there's not principles involved, but in a lot of civil wars, there's all of this sort of undercurrent of very personal, family-based division. Mm-hmm. And it's very volatile and it's very eruptive. Mm-hmm. And it makes it very hard to sort of understand where you stand, because you may be with the Sandinistas today, and of course, so much has happened over the last few decades, and the Sandinistas of today are
they're total screwballs
what
now.
What they were then, which is a whole other story.
But the in-between thing. So when you come home, you're expected to help raise money for the program that you're doing wherever it is, because they have. Where I was being funded by Trocare in Ireland and Oxfam in England. That's where they're getting the money from. So we heard that one of the Kennedys Ted Kennedy was very involved with trying to figure out how to stop this Contra bullshit and do some sensible work. So we called the office and they said, well, we'd like to see you. And we came over and saw them and they said, who you really have to talk to is this group called?
The Indian Law Resource Center in D.C.
So we go with our son, Ariel Fiscatori, into this place. Yes. There we are as a family talking to these guys. And they want to know exactly where I've been and what I've seen.
Oh, man.
Well, could you say that again, sir? I said, I just told you. And they're writing every damn thing down that I'm saying. So pretty soon, Gail Vittori, in her usual way, senses there's something up. Kicks me. Can you help me with Ariel in the bathroom? Okay. So we get up and go to the bathroom. And so lo and behold, she says, change this conversation because these are the wrong guys to talk to and Kennedy's office made a mistake. So lo and behold, these guys, as I changed the conversation, were actually part of the whole Contra scene.
Oh my goodness.
And I was telling them exactly what I shouldn't be telling them.
But you'd already told them.
Yeah, and so we got a hold of Richard Newbold Adams.
Who is he?
He's the guy that heads up the University of Texas.
Institute for Latin American Studies at UT. He was the one who sort of connected us initially to the whole project.
And we said, what the hell do we do? Kennedy's office does not know that this group is part of the other end of things. And so he said, forget the entire trip, never mention this again, or your nonprofit will not exist.
Wow. I had no idea the interview was going to go here. This is amazing. Thank you all for sharing this. It seems trite to take it back into building systems now after going here. So just wrap up the story. Where does this go?
Conclusion of the Nicaragua work was essentially there's no ways anything can get built here at this time of war.
Get the hell out.
We needed to be very conscious of Pliny becoming a target. And it basically was the concluding chapter of that work that otherwise could have led to something really amazing.
I was an advisor to 7 different Indian nations because they said, whoa, what you did down there, how they found out, God knows. Save the children, partially found out. So here I was traveling to Indian nations. And as that began to happen, then Bob Birkebile eventually began to say, we'd love to get you involved with the Committee on the Environment.
And so Bob was the Omega Institute.
Bob was an architect of that, but he's the principal, one of the founders of the architecture firm based in Kansas City, BNIM Architects.
But he's the
founder of the Committee on the Environment for the AIA. So now we're into the 90s. So we just moved from the 80s.
Okay, let's do the 90s now. The beginning of the AIA Cote Committee.
So what was sort of interesting is that, as usual, I was always a complainer on the committee. So they say, you know, let's do life cycle analysis of this and that and on and on and on. I said, a complex building, it's impossible to do all these life cycles. It would be so expensive that we would get nowhere time-wise or cost-wise. So they said, Fisk, what would you do? And I came up with this crazy, crazy idea instantaneously of going and combining the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the input-output analysis of the economy and overlaying it in a gigantic matrix of all the businesses in the U.S. with the EPA reporting of greenhouse gases, criteria air pollutants, and toxic release. And they said, what the hell would that do?
Environmental accounting.
They said, exactly. I said, every dollar of flow in this and between that, and if you can go and take the CSI categories for specification and link them to businesses, you've got a linkage of architecture into the entire flow of pollution and dollars in the U.S. economy. And they said, you can do that? I said, no way. I need lots of help.
Mm-hmm.
And so they funded $250,000 within about 6 months. And we did the first national model that actually overlaid those two very critical things, the flow of pollution and the flow of money. And so when things like the Pentagon came along or many other buildings that we were associated with, we could actually go and mine down and figure out where do we start,
mm-hmm.
instead of hypothetically saying, hey, let's do windows this time. That looks like a good one. Or carpets, or whatever, without any knowledge of which is the most important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so I think the work was just beginning to establish. In fact, it created something called the Environmental Resource Guide. So that was really the first introduction. Nadav Malin worked on that.
Right.
Joel Antot worked on that. Greg Norris worked on that. So I think the Environmental Resource Guide, 1991-92.
Wow.
And around that time in Texas, we had an opportunity to do some really fantastic work associated with the General Services Commission. So early 90s was the time in Texas when we had a lot of really fabulous people who were ready to make stuff happen in the state, right? And including in the realm of buildings and energy. So we had an opportunity to rewrite the architecture and engineering guidelines of the General Services Commission. That was a contract that we had.
Wow, incredible.
First time that there was a state guideline like that that included an indoor air quality section. This was the first time we were able that it was done, and we had an opportunity to be the authors of that. It was also a time when we were able to convene a series of professional training seminars. Because once we changed the guidelines, no one knew what to do. And I remember going into the office of the General Services Commission and talking to Pete Parsons, who is now the director of the Texas Solar Energy Society.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, she was a senior staff person at the General Services Commission. And I went into the building and I smelled paint that had just been applied. And I said, Pete, like, we need to train people. Like, they do not understand what's just has been adopted. And so she said, tell me what you want to do. And I said, I want to do a series of seminars to train people, to educate them on what this meant in terms of their day-to-day work. And so we were greenlit to do a series. We did them for 2.5 years.
Wow.
Of professional training seminars on topics like indoor air quality, on sustainable building materials, on energy performance. I mean, just like we wrote our job. Basically. And that was incredible. We had Bill McDonough that came and did the kickoff
and Bob,
talk for
Bob
that.
Bob too.
Bob was involved. I mean, we were
back in the 90s.
Job. This was in the 90s. We have all the documents of that. There, I think, was at that time, you'll remember. So we went from 89 was the year that we came up with the idea for the Austin Green Building Program.
Mm-hmm.
That was recognized by the Earth Summit in 1992. In 1993 was when the U.S. Green Building Council was formed, and in 1995 was when the first concept of LEED was established.
And so they all looked at Austin as their model.
Mm-hmm.
Those years from like 89, oh, and then in 88, that was another key year, was the Brundtland Report, which established the very first public definition of sustainable development, right?
You were just at the nexus of all this.
Well, not only the nexus, but what was really, really interesting. You know how many states followed?
I don't.
They said, if Texas could do it, we can do it better. And that's exactly what you want to have happen.
Mm-hmm.
A nonprofit organization, you want it repeated. So all of a sudden, there are 43 states.
Wow.
All of a sudden, the Austin Green Building Program gets a lot of publicity. Do you know how many eventually came out worldwide of cities that did similar? 600.
Part of it too was trying to understand the different ways of different modes people have to learn and the different opportunities to teach. And so in addition to doing the guidelines, which was like sort of like here's how you do your job, then we did the training seminars. We also did a video called Sustainable Building in Texas, something
and
because
he
of
loved the fact that the Capitol.
Yeah, so we started right the video.
Was a beautiful, beautifully done climatic building.
Yeah, the video starts with Larry Speck, who at the time was the dean of the School of Architecture, and he sort of intros with this kind of timeless way of building and design. And then we go into the original design concept of the state capitol. So the whole idea of this was to demystify green building as being something that was just new and untested. So we go in and we have one of the architectural historians who really knew the Capitol intimately. And we walk through it with her where she's showing the original airflow designs that the air without air conditioning, right, would be all through convection, would go up to cool the spaces. And there were these convective chimneys
effect,
to go out.
The way
the galleries were designed with these specifically designed shutters that would enable them to modulate the daylight during the course of the day.
Love it.
And it was all temperature and daylight connected.
It was just such a perfect way. And so that was all about the demystification of green building, right? Trying to convince these heads of departments like the Department of Transportation and the Department of Prisons and so on to say, this is something you can do and this is something that you should do. In the same way, I think it's very parallel to the healthcare sector, right? It's kind of reintroducing something that had been very fundamental in healthcare design. Think of Florence Nightingale. It was all about access to fresh air, right? So much of what she promoted. And we had to sort of undo the changed learning about how to design healthcare, right? To then say, let's go back to these first principles. And that's what this is all about. Go back to principles.
So what would happen if we took the Austin Green Building Program and the diagram of a feedback city, which by the way, was the diagram printed in the Earth Summit Award because ICLEI thought this is how the future city should work.
A feedback city.
Feedback city.
Yeah, maybe you could unpack that a little bit. What does that mean to you?
So feedback city was borrowed lock, stock, and barrel from cybernetics.
Mm.
So an urban or organism and the environment try to work with each other and their feedback mechanisms.
Mm.
So the environment is the public sector and the organism is the private sector.
Oh, man, that's big.
So all of a sudden, you're beginning to get a cycle that goes through the 42 commissions. And they say, we are in big, big trouble with water, big, big trouble with solid waste, big, big trouble with it. So let's put this to the city council and let's put an incentive out to the private sector. And the private sector says, you're out of your mind. We're not going to do that. So it cycles back again. Whoa. Things are getting worse. So we've got to do more incentives. So we've got to do a rating system that begins to say you get more points if you do this. more points if you do that. So all of a sudden, this thing becomes more and more connected and more related to how an organism of a city works.
Right. You're providing feedback mechanisms to guide behavior.
Exactly. About a year or two ago, Gail and I started writing some position papers, a systems view of saving the world.
Love it.
So what did we do? We combined baseline reading at the national level with the feedback model of Austin, Texas.
Oh, wow.
And then we began to say, whoa, in order to get good feedback, we have got to get all the green building, whatever metrics there are out there, of which there are many. Some are health related, some are living building challenge related, some are LEED, some are whatever it is. And we've got to get together and we've got to come and use a feedback data procedure that helps us all. And there's a satellite system, and several satellite systems, that can go and give us unbelievable feedback these days at every level. Water, air, food, energy, you name it. So as a body of effort called all these metrics together, we first of all cooperate with each other and we go and get the satellite people to actually do a whole systems way of thinking about not only the country, but eventually the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Incredible. So it's kind of like truly like an environmental sensing, like all of humanity is the organism, something like
so that. So the sad thing is this. So we put a whole model together and presented it at the American Solar Energy Society. And they loved this thing. But I realized where I was in Washington, D.C. Six blocks away was who? The Rockefeller Foundation. So I made another copy. I did a personal letter to the head of it, personal letter to him, handwritten. So no feedback, no feedback. No feedback. And so here we are talking to the Mitchell Foundation here in Austin. And we begin to say, you know, there's a real problem going on out there. And that problem is that these foundations are up against the wall, it looks like. Because as soon as this whole Trumpian thing has happened and USAID is X'd out, they're shifting their money to make up for the U.S. government on a global basis.
Oh my goodness.
So if you're not talking about things that are in their bailiwick already, and you're having this other big, bigger idea, they either get it or they don't. And they settle back with their homework that they feel as though they have to do because the world is in such trouble that the $100 million that the Rockefeller Foundation had out there for an ingenious idea has disappeared. So the ingenious ideas have come back down to doing everyday on-the-ground work as we used to work, not at the next level.
Wow.
That's all I have to say.
That's deep. And I think it's almost appropriate, right? You need to keep the work on the ground going.
You do have to do that, but you have to think at the next level, like the Austin Green Building Program and Baseline Green.
Mm-hmm. So Baseline Green, I just want to be clear, that's a protocol that you've developed to think about this larger input-output life cycle.
Well, it's based on national databases, right? So
we did not make up anything.
There's a tremendous amount of data that exists. And so how to leverage data that exists to give you the benefit of being able to figure out some of these wicked problems.
Yeah.
That's really, I think, something that we've had opportunities to take advantage of. And I think we've only just barely scraped the surface of what can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have AI, right? So, I mean, it's like, it's gigantic what can be done.
So what you're saying is that the latest sort of focus of CMPBS is saving the world, but really looking at the planet as a system, or is it the U.S.?
Well, it could start at the U.S., but our diagrams have the world.
But you're looking at what existing data can be mapped onto global solutions, something like that?
Yeah, and then you also look for patterns. Like, we've done a lot of work with biomes as patterns in the world. So if you see similar patterns of flora, fauna, climate, hydrology, so on, right? You say, back to appropriate technology, right? What works here in this biome, there's a good chance there's going to be relevance in a similar biome somewhere else in the world. So use that as a basis for technology sharing, as opposed to saying, here's an idea, go use it, and not have it be contextually connected, which is a problem oftentimes.
And the thing that's sort of very interesting to me is when you bring this up at various forums, like recently, a very important person from India was here doing a lead type effort nationally in India. And so on our way to the meeting, I did a little bit of homework and searched out, does India have an IO, LCA way of thinking?
Mm.
Lo and behold, they have every single business located and what they're doing, money flow and environmental impact. And I was totally floored.
That's so cool.
So you begin to realize, to assume that you're doing it only here is not only the wrong assumption, but if it's true, we're in deep shit.
Mm-hmm.
There are many countries out there that have a similar, almost their way of operating.
Mm-hmm. So it's clear that you guys have had your fingers in a lot of really important situations over many, many years. I mean, CMPBS is at 50 years now. That's huge.
Of serious commotion.
50 years of serious commotion. Where do you see it leading?
So it's interesting what happened with these national models. As Dale said, you begin to see patterns. And you begin to see how you could identify things with a very robust way of thinking that uses very vetted data and technique that you're not making up in your hilltop crazy laboratory. And that's meaningful, because when we use this model to go and do things like, oh, let's specify this building called the U.S. Pentagon. So we did the green specking, Gail did, of the U.S. Pentagon. So we thought, what a perfect example of having to use a very robust model to figure out where the hell do we start?
Wow. Yeah, that's daunting.
So we began to take one area, interiors, and delve in and mine deeper and deeper. If you're specking the U.S. Pentagon, you have to have your shit together, including vetted everything. Otherwise, no one's going to listen. So lo and behold, what glowed? Wiring.
Hmm.
So every $1 million worth of activity for that particular product specification for the U.S. Pentagon was gigantic. And then we started moving out and out and out, and we sort of said, wow, wiring. What building doesn't have wiring? You begin to realize, my goodness, all buildings practically have wiring unless it's your tool shed in the back of your house. But maybe even that has wiring. So wiring's big. So then we shifted perspective and we said, we're talking about a gigantic ecosystem of technologies inputting and outputting to each other, and some of them being bad and some of them being better. And when you replace certain ones, it ricochets into a whole shitload of others. And then you shift a little bit further and you say, my goodness, if you use ecosystems way of thinking, you're beginning to identify keystones, like keystone species in an ecosystem that runs everything else. So gradually, you're beginning to come up with a list of industries that need to be shifted. So in the Pentagon, Gail Vittori figured out a way of specking wiring and concrete in a way that got past all the hierarchy of whoever.
Wow.
So they did sensible wiring. Now, we did not set this up, but it is interesting that the one wedge in the U.S. Pentagon that was hit got hit on the wrong wedge from the standpoint it was the only wedge that was redone. Now, we began to realize there's a lot of keystones, a lot of industrial ecosystems.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you begin to put these on a map and you begin to say, my goodness, what happens if we replace this one with one of these that we've discovered that's greener? What is the ricochet? So then we begin to do crazy things of looking at water in Texas. Big topic. So lo and behold, you begin to realize there are a lot of efforts all across the state for produced water, which means that there is a waste product called brine from the produced water.
Mm.
Now, right now, that brine is used for fracking. What happens if it weren't? What's in the brine? So you begin to realize, my goodness, the number four constituent is magnesium oxide.
Huh. Cement.
You take magnesium oxide from this brackish water and produce cement, and how much is there? So we go to Hark in Houston, and we get the data because they did analysis for the state of Texas of how much brine there is. There is so much brine waste that you can replace 110% of all the Portland cement in a state that uses more Portland cement than any other state in the country by what's being wasted.
That's beautiful. That's huge.
So, whoa, you begin to say, oh my goodness, here's another keystone industry.
Mm-hmm.
And as a byproduct of that, you're getting fresh water. And this is, by the way, inevitable because we're running out of water.
Yeah.
So you've got cement and water. And by the way, you have something else called hydrogen, depending on the process that you use industry-wise to do that. So now you begin to collect these industries one after another. And then you get into this weird thing. There happen to be about 26 of them that we've located.
Huh. Interesting number.
And then one of these young interns says, you know what 26 means? There's 26 cubes in the Rubik cube. Do you know how many possibilities there are? 43 quintillion. So all of a sudden, you're beginning to hybridize these things in ways that can produce what we now call the Global Dream Lab.
Oh, here we are at the Global Dream Lab.
We're finally there.
So if you don't mind, go back. How did hydrogen fit into magnesium oxide and water?
Well, there are many ways of getting that magnesium out of the brine. There's, you know, sophisticated filtration processes. Depending how you design the filter, you're getting out the magnesium. That's one of many. And then there's electrolysis. You know, it's been proved by Columbia University that wind and sun can run the electrolysis, and you're getting out the magnesium, and that you can produce the magnesium as cement with solar energy because it's so low in the amount of temperature that it needs to get the cementitious part of the magnesium operating from a chemical standpoint. So all of a sudden, you're beginning to realize, whoa, there are opportunities there that opens up a whole new world that we call the Dream Lab.
So virtuous cycles, new ways of existing, new ways of doing.
We have many entries in the Dream Lab now. And they are ranging from air, water, food, energy, materials, to transportation.
Gail, could you kind of summarize the Global Dream Lab for us in your own words?
I think the amazing thing about the Global Dream Lab is that it's bringing tangible form to a way of thinking that is anticipatory,
mm-hmm.
that is essential to unlock some of the wicked problems that don't seem to get in a solution context. So meaning that we're a small organization, and one of the things that we've been very lucky about is finding opportunities to get our way of thinking out and having some level of influence.
Yeah.
And I think over the 50 years, we can identify several of these ideas that have found their way out way beyond our realm of what we would think our sphere of influence is to something much bigger. And that to me is the true measure of success, mm-hmm. of why we exist. And to the extent the Global Dream Lab becomes a compilation of addressing some of these really big challenges that are confronting our sense of what the future looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really important part of what we have going on here now.
Mm-hmm.
I am only in the most tangential way associated with it.
But that was good. That was a great description.
It really was.
All right.
And so it's a great description of something that's hard to describe.
And I'll say I'm often an observer, and I enjoy being an observer because it enriches my sense of what is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's great value in that because it stretches my mind and gives me more, I'd say, boldness to push things in the context that I work in, maybe well beyond what I would otherwise do. So I think that's part of the synergy that works really well. And I think it also is, there's a certain contagiousness about it. And so I think one of the things that happened to people who work with us, and certainly part of our 50-year legacy, is all the people that have been part of this and contributed to it and stretched us and stretched their collaborators, is that it's a place where stretching is really a good and important part of what we do and how we work. And to understand the value of being in an environment that encourages that and to make it be the way that we view the best outcomes happening, that to me is the 50-year legacy.
Yeah. Gail, that was tremendous. I mean,
it's fantastic.
You encapsulated a difficult topic to encapsulate, so I would like to give you applause. And I'd also like to just remind what we've heard on this interview is a tour de force who's who of the sustainable building industry, but not the sustainable building industry, the sustainable planet, the sustainable humanity industry, right? It's, yeah, congratulations and thank you for touching so many areas of reality and of our world. And there's all the stuff that's actually happening in the world and where the money flows currently go. But what just seems like a lighthouse to me is there are so many people that really care. There are so many people that see that we're going in the many wrong directions. And at some point, humanity is going to come hungry for the ideas that you've created. And there they'll be. And that is heartening for me. I mean, I wish we were there now. I'm hungry.
Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of folks don't realize this, but we've had interns now from 56 universities worldwide.
Wow.
So I have interns at this moment in time from Taiwan, India, Nepal, Arkansas. And so all of a sudden you begin to realize, well, these people are the future.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. These people, all of us.
All of us are the future. But what they're experiencing here is so important, and they're so grabbing for knowledge that is connected to what we do. Like the discussion the other day with, I only get female interns for some reason, no guys anymore, that all of a sudden they say, man, the Global Dream Lab should be an advanced studio at every engineering architecture school in the country. I say, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. And they're serious. And then we're dealing, you know, with a...
And then they'll be deans of architecture schools in future years.
Yeah, right. But wouldn't it be great? Global Dream Lab Studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gail, it looks like you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think one of the things we're looking forward to in the context of the 50th anniversary is a celebration in October. And we'll have some big announcements at that point. And we'll also, I think, have the Global Dream Lab ready for folks to see it up close and personal. That's one of our hopes, to be pulling it together. But I think it'll be a time to sort of reflect, but also more importantly, think about where we are and where we're going. And we hope that you and your visitors can come out and be part of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just want to thank you again for taking the time today to share all these ideas with us. And so much beyond that, just thank you for 50 years of undaunted optimism and swimming upstream and big ideas, really big, important ideas. So
thank you, Christoph. It was a lot of fun.
You're welcome. And thank you again. And Pliny, thank you for being, actually, I don't know if you know, you've been an implicit mentor of mine for 20 years, 25 years, something like that.
Wow.
So thank you. And thank you, listeners, for being here. And we'll talk to you next time.